This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. This is quite a tremendous day in the news. Britain has decided to leave the European Union. And for us at the Trumpet, this is quite amazing to witness. This is something we've been watching for since 1973, when Britain first joined the European Economic Community, and even quite a ways before that as well. Herbert W. Armstrong was forecasting the rise of a United States of Europe and saying Britain would not be a part of it. And now we are seeing these headlines right before our eyes. This is a monumental event that has a lot of fascinating implications, and you can't help but be stirred and moved to see this happening. I've invited a couple of extra people to join our discussion today. We have a lot to talk about here in the studio. We have Robert Morley.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
We have Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
And Jeremiah Jacques.
Pleasure to be with you.
And we have via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello, it's going to be a pleasure.
And we also have from our office in the great land of Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brad McDonald.
Hello.
So this is a super, super abundantly packed panel that we have today. But gentlemen, last night I was actually going to the airport to pick up Stephen Fleury, who is now visiting here in Oklahoma. And we were talking about the vote and what was going to happen, what the implications would be. And at the time when we were talking about it, it seemed like the stay vote had the upper hand. It looked likelier that they were going to stay in the European Union. But we were just commenting about how much more dramatic it would be if the leave camp actually won. And when I got home, I checked my computer, and sure enough, they were calling it at that point that Britain was actually going to get out of the European Union. I turned on it was the Sky News live stream. It was the British television. It came up beautifully on my computer, and I just could not stop watching this as they were talking about all of the different demographics, how the vote was breaking down, what the implications were going to be. And this really is a truly momentous event that we have witnessed. We're actually finishing the August edition of the Trumpet Magazine today. We've cleared out, I believe, 6 pages that we're going to devote to this. Richard, you've been working on articles all morning long to that we'll be able to put in here. We've got a whole lot that we can talk about in this, but we're going to put this on the cover. We're going to put this on the back cover. So it's exciting to have this getting out right away. This will be going to the printer today. So I just wanted to talk a little bit at the beginning. Mr. Fleury spoke about this on the Trumpet Daily show this morning. We have to mention Mr. Armstrong and just what how he said this was going to happen. The quotes that he read, even back in 1956, there was a quote from The Plain Truth I forget what exactly the source was, 1956. The stage is all set. The Germans are coming back from the destruction of World War II in breathtaking manner. Germany is the economic and military heart of Europe. Probably Germany will lead and dominate the coming United States of Europe, but Britain will be no part of it. 1956. Mr. Armstrong was absolutely right. And anybody who has heard from him and watched over the years and heard the Trumpet talk about this over the years has to be pretty stunned to see this actually happen. But I want to start by just talking about some of the things that we learned in the vote itself and the way that the demographics broke between different parts of the UK, different ages, and so on. Richard, why don't you maybe talk a little bit about some of the things that we learned from the vote itself?
Right. Well, one thing we saw was just a lot of division. I think it was just very interesting to see some of the statistics. So, for example, for young people under the age of 25 that voted, 75% voted to stay in. only 25% out. And then when you also consider that that demographic is one of the ones that is least involved typically in voting, least likely to vote, then you have a tiny, tiny level of support for leaving the European Union from young people. And so that's, I mean, that's one thing that's causing division. And then there's a lot of resentment there. I think a lot of it wrong, but already there was kind of this narrative within Britain that the old people are doing a great injustice to the young people, that government spending that affects young people like welfare is being cut to the bone while pensions have a triple lock, that government housing policy means that nobody under the age of 40 can afford to buy a house while the older generation has made a huge amount of money from rising house prices. Like I said, I think a lot of that criticism is unfair. Pension and welfare are very different things. But that just plays into now that narrative and this belief that, you know, a lot of young people are saying, well, we've had our opportunity to travel around Europe has been destroyed. There's one thing that's kind of been doing the rounds from the Financial Times that's kind of gone viral on the internet saying, well, how many marriages now and friendships are never going to happen because of what the old people have done to us. Like I said, I don't agree with a lot of that, but it's important to note that that division is there. And then I think then the other big divide that this referendum exposed was there was not a single district in Scotland that voted to leave the European Union. And then London as well overwhelmingly voted to stay in the European Union, and then Northern Ireland too. And so this has reopened the Scottish debate. There's a strong push now even already from Nicola Sturgeon to have another Scottish referendum within the next 2 years. So it'll be very interesting to see how that works out. Even Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, has started flirting with the idea of London independence. I think that's a bit of a joke. Wow. But just the geographic split there is also very interesting.
Yeah, that was the most surprising part to me. Is we were obviously really excited yesterday. Actually, our social media director, David Vigil, and I were actually here in the office till like midnight last night, just huddled around the computer watching each county on the BBC map as it filled in whether it's yellow or blue. And just noticing that, I mean, like you said, other than London and some parts in southeastern England, pretty much all of England and Wales was mostly blue. But Scotland, once you crossed the border into Scotland, I mean, the entire thing was yellow. And I always knew Scotland was a little more pro-EU than England was, but I just didn't know it was that stark. That, I mean, it just seemed like that in the entire northern half of Britain there just wanted to stay, while the southern half wanted to leave.
Right. Yeah. The idea that both of these, Northern Ireland and Scotland, would say, well, we want to distance ourselves from the UK and rejoin the European Union, that's in play.
Right. One thing that stood out to me ahead of the vote, Joseph de Courcy is an analyst that he doesn't seem to write much these days, but we quote him a fair bit. And what he does write is usually pretty insightful. And ahead of the vote, he said, you know, Britain votes to leave. Britain is going to allow a European power on the continent, a single European power on the continent, which it's always sought to oppose. But secondly, that power's first objective will be to break up the United Kingdom. Now, I don't know exactly how that would play out, but you can see the potential for that already.
One interesting, I guess, part of this to keep in mind is Scotland has to, I mean, if I was Scotland, I would wait to find out what I was leaving to. If I'm Scotland and I want to break away now and join the EU, are you joining a failing, disintegrating entity? Which I guess that question will be answered over the next year or two. But it's not as simple and straightforward as Scotland saying, we're done, we're going to go to this healthy, robust, thriving European Union that we're going to become a fantastic member of.
You think about just how many questions this raises, how much this throws up into the air in terms of the future of Britain and Europe. If you were just looking at it without any kind of biblical understanding, underpinning, or framework, you'd have to say, well, it's just we're staring into a fog here.
I think the other, when you mentioned questions, a question that's really important to think about is Northern Ireland. a lot of the peace process between the Republic of Ireland and the UK was built on things like the European Court of Human Rights, which played a fairly large part in that, the Camp David Accords. Now, that's not the European Union, but it's associated with it. Britain may withdraw from that in the process of withdrawing from the European Union. You know, a lot of the peace there stems from this idea of, well, it doesn't matter so much if Northern Ireland and the rest of Ireland are in different countries because we're all part of the EU and we're kind of all moving towards a federal superstate anyway. With that changing, could this reopen the old wounds of the peace process and Northern Ireland and the terrorists there? And already Sinn Féin, the political arm of the terrorist group, the IRA, are saying, well, we need to have a vote now on whether Northern Ireland should be part of the Republic of Ireland. So that's another major possible sore point from this.
Yeah, they were even talking on Sky News last night about just the fact that there's no border between them. There's no border protection between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. That all of a sudden, I mean, it's the one place where you actually have a shared border between the UK and Europe now.
Right.
Yeah, and what, I think that's really up in the air what happens there, because as I understand it, the border agreement between Britain and Ireland, or I should say the UK and Ireland, is not dependent upon the European Union. It's a separate agreement because Ireland is not part of the Schengen area. But the European Union, I mean, it has an influence on all of that.
You know, another aspect of division that we saw in this vote was just how different the leaders of Britain are thinking from the people of Britain. And you had, I think it was probably three quarters of the leaders who had expressed a view publicly about their what they wanted to do here was to stay. And so to have a majority of the people, you know, David Cameron said, well, I'm not going to be able to lead Britain into its future. Obviously, immediately, as soon as it was known that the Leave camp had won, he has no legitimacy as a representative of his people. Somebody else is going to have to step in. And it really brings up a lot of questions as to who's going to lead Britain in the future and what is that going to look like.
And even it looks like Jeremy Corbyn might not, the Labour leader, he might not outlast the next week, because Labour voted in huge numbers for exit. And Labour has been very pro-EU in the past decades. There's all kinds of interesting leadership crises where the grassroots of both parties want something very different to what the top leaders do. And then it's the leaders of the financial sector, a lot of business leaders, religious leaders, both the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Archbishop of York, you know, the top leaders of the Church of England, came out in favor of Britain staying within the European Union. So in just about every single walk of life, the elite and the top were saying, stay in, the people voted out. I think one thing with all of this division that might help drive it home to maybe our American listeners is imagine what would happen if Donald Trump became president. That's the same kind of reaction I think that a lot of people in Britain are having today.
Yeah, Richard, I think that's just a very important point that you bring out, this dichotomy we have between the leadership of Britain and the people. And I think going forward, it'll be very interesting to see what the leadership actually does. Because if you take a look at what a lot of analysts are saying out there is that, okay, this doesn't really mean that Britain's going to leave. It just means that now Britain can negotiate a little better deal within Europe. And, oh, Germany will now come to the table and they'll throw out some things. And it will be interesting to see what the leadership does, because this is something we've seen all across Europe. We've seen the leadership really out of step with the people. And this is something that can lead to a lot of instability. This is something that I think can lead to a lot of social and socioeconomic type problems. I think that's probably something else that's in Britain's future.
Well, at this point, you know, thinking about who would step into the prime ministership and what that would look like, it seems like so much. You mentioned, say, the way that a lot of the elites within Britain are feeling towards, say, the Leave leaders. It would be comparable to the way that a lot of the elites in the United States look at Donald Trump, where it's almost like this guy is he doesn't even belong at the table in their view. And that's kind of the way that some of those some of the more prominent Leave leaders come across to, you know, the more establishment candidates in Britain.
Sort of. Nigel Farage is probably the most prominent, but he's certainly not at the top of anyone's list to become the next prime minister.
Right.
Those that are, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, they are not. You could weigh in on this, Richard, but they're not considered as radical or as extreme as Donald Trump. I suppose some of the liberals would, but they're mainstream politicians, if they are, even if they are more conservative.
Yeah, I generally agree. I think my point with the Donald Trump comparison was more, imagine how the population of, say, New York and some of those northeastern states, or California, and a lot of the journalists, say, writing for the New York Times, would react if Donald Trump became president. There would just be like, what is this happening to my country? This is not what I believe in, what everybody around me believes in. This is completely alien to my experience of America, for people living in those pockets. And that's, I think, how people, say, living in London, and then people in that whole kind of general social group has responded to this vote. It's kind of like a disbelief and a, you know, nobody I know votes for Brexit. How did this happen kind of
response. It'd be tonight would be a great night to be at some of the London dinner parties and to hear all these people discuss what just happened. Because you're right, it is. I think there are a lot of people in Britain walking around today thinking, wow, it actually happened. Everyone knows about it. I've kind of got a little bit of that sentiment. We've been talking about this for months and months and months, but it just happened. This is actually happening. I think a lot of people, even if they knew it was a possibility, they're still a little surprised and shocked that it actually happened.
I think even a lot of pro-exit people are
absolutely
very surprised it happened.
Right.
One of the things that I think is interesting to consider is just how much we've been talking about all of the problems that are associated with British membership in the European Union, and a lot of people are discussing this as if this is the solution to so many of Britain, so many of the things that ail Britain, and yet so many of Britain's problems have nothing to do with EU membership, and those problems aren't going away. And the fact that, you know, there are a lot of issues that need to be resolved now with how do we extricate ourselves in the least problematic way, we still have all of these other things on the table. Let's just talk a little bit about some of the things that Britain still has to face in spite of having withdrawn from the EU.
I suppose immigration would be a big one. I've seen quite a bit, even like Niall Farage and stuff, they're really trying to bring that out. And I mean, they do blame a lot of that on EU policies that are not allowing Britain to defend its borders. But I guess now that they've, declared independence, I mean, that does put the British people back in the driver's seat, but they still have to decide what they're going to do about an issue like that.
And that is an interesting one, because there's still a strong, you know, a lot of people want to be in the common market after exiting the European Union, and it's quite likely that immigration, open borders would be a requirement of Britain remaining in the common market even after it leaves the EU. That's the European Economic Area, separate to the European Union. So it is very possible that Britain could end up leaving the EU and still not having control over immigration.
Richard, talking about the economic implications of this, I think this is something that could be one of the bigger things going forward. There's been a lot of people talking about, you know, Britain pays more into the EU, and there is a lot of benefits that they will have by leaving. But the big question is, how is Europe going to respond to this? You know, if Europe responds by saying, look, you're outside of the union, you've made your decision known, well, then you're going to be treated as somebody who's outside Europe. And maybe you should be treated not like someone like Switzerland, but maybe somebody more like, oh, I don't know, somebody from like India or Australia or some other nation that doesn't have these preferential trade. And this could be big, because the instability resulting from having to renegotiate all these things, maybe even leading to retaliatory type measures. I mean, what the potentials that we're seeing here, I think, could be huge economically. If you just look at how the markets reacted this morning, it was dramatic. The pound fell by 10%. That's the biggest drop in its entire history of the British pound. opening this morning. So this is massive. If you look at the markets, I don't know how much time you want to spend on this, but I mean that the German market was down by 6%. You start adding up the S&P 500 in America. America's not even directly tied to it. It was down its biggest day since 1986. So we're talking trillions of dollars evaporated between last night when people... yesterday when people were voting and when the world woke up this morning and found out that they had completely mispriced the risk of Britain leaving the European Union. Now people are waking up and saying, oh boy, what has happened here? And now this is the point where Britain's at. Nobody knows what this really means. Like, remember President Obama, he went and visited the UK just back in April. And he said, well, I'm not here to influence the vote. But then he went on to try to influence the vote. But basically what he told Britain was, if you vote to leave, get in the back of the queue, meaning, you know, don't be looking to us to come and bail you out if you do this. We won't be signing those preferential trade agreements with you, or if we will, it's going to take, you know, we'll see how long that's going to take.
Which apparently some Britons felt like was a pretty good plug for the leave camp. The fact that Barack Obama tried so hard to influence.
Well, here's the reality, though. Thousands of American companies use Britain as the entry port to the European Union. Britain's financial sector, the City of London, the single biggest, most strategic part of Britain's economy, the largest or second largest financial center in the world. A lot of that is because that's American banks and financial houses and pensions and mutual funds, all of that, the financial industry funnels into Europe through the City of London. That is under threat. And that is something that Frankfurt and Paris have been envying ever since Britain joined the common market. Now, if that is at threat, then this could be a massive blow to Britain. So that in itself is something that we need to watch. And if there is retaliation, if who knows what's going to happen with America, but we've been seeing this divergence between U.S. policy and British policy. This is a trend we've been watching. It's been dividing, so I don't think we can look for a lot of support from the United States for Britain's decision to leave. And this could have huge implications for the people of Britain.
Well, I definitely want to follow up on how Europe might respond to what's happening here. Go ahead, Brad.
Well, just one thing on that, the point you just brought up about, okay, will this solve Britain's problems? As you guys were talking, I was just thinking about what are Britain's top problems? We've got the economy, massive debt. We've got immigration. We've got Islam and multiculturalism, a huge problem here. We've got the broken entitlement system. We've got bankrupt institutions, the NHS, not to mention Britain's known for its social problems, single motherhood, drunks on the street every Friday and Saturday night. If I think about those top four or five problems, not one of those is any closer to being solved by Britain leaving the EU. In terms of, you know, when some of the leavers, you know, they sold this as this is going to fix Britain's problems, you know, those people have a reality check coming. It does nothing to fix it.
Right. Yeah, Europe didn't do anything to turn London into Londonistan.
Right.
Well, I think the one thing some of the leavers may have right about this is immigration policy. Seems like some of it is being driven by, maybe I'm wrong about this, Richard, you can correct me about this, but I think this has been one of the big complaints from the UK is that, you know,
Eastern Europe, not from the world.
You're right. A lot of that has been coming from.
It's come from Eastern Europe. The rest of the immigrants to the UK actually come outside the.
Right.
Right. India, Pakistan, a lot of the remnants of the British Empire. There is a lot of that. Absolutely.
And the Muslims come from, they're not coming from Poland. I mean, you're right. As Britain leaves the EU now, they probably will renegotiate some immigration policies to fix the Polish coming in and driving our trucks. But that won't fix some of the Muslim immigration.
And just to kind of tie that back to some of the points you were making on the economy, you know, I think I really liked an article Ambrose Evans Pritchard had a week or two ago, where basically I think it's quite clear. If Britain left the European Union, I'm quite convinced within 20 years or so, it would be a net positive. Britain's economy would be doing better. We'd be out from a lot of the regulations. The government would be able to take control. You know, Steve Hilton, who was a former advisor to the government, he talked about just how much of the paperwork going on at Whitehall comes from the European Union. and the government just can't even get on with the business of government and even in some ways fixing some of these problems because of all of the massive paperwork they're getting from Brussels. But look at the self-inflicted problems Britain has with its economy, the massive debt. You know, the only countries with bigger debt in the European Union or bigger deficits than Britain are countries like Greece and Spain. Britain's trade deficit is at its highest level since records began in the late 1700s. So, you know, yes, all things being equal, probably Britain could come out of the European Union and thrive. But this is the we've wounded ourselves so much already that now we're vulnerable. We wouldn't necessarily be vulnerable without those wounds. I think we could possibly weather some of the retaliation and things like that. But we're not in great health to begin with. And then that makes possible retaliation and things that could come on from Europe and possible knock-on effects to the City of London, that kind of thing. That makes those so much more dangerous.
Well, this is a good place to take a break. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're talking about the implications on Britain of its decision to leave the European Union. Coming up, we're going to talk about the implications for Europe because of Britain's decision. With that discussion, we'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You are listening to Trumpet Hour. We're talking about Britain's decision to leave the European Union. We're going to focus now on some of the broader implications for Europe and what we can expect to see in the time ahead within Europe. I want to start by just talking about Gibraltar and some of Britain's colonial interests. This obviously puts Gibraltar in a really interesting situation. Jeremiah, why don't you tell us about this?
Sure. Yeah, with a lot of these issues regarding the EU's response to the Brexit, we do have to, as you said, just make informed guesses and speculation at this point. But in this particular area, Europe's reaction to Gibraltar, there has already been a pretty powerful statement that came out from the EU. The Spanish government this morning said that since Britain has opted to leave, the Spanish flag on the Rock of Gibraltar is much closer than ever before. And the foreign ministry spokesman there, I think it was, called for co-sovereignty. So instead of British rule over the rock, the way it's been since, I think, 1713, now he's saying let's have a sort of co-sovereignty with Spain and Britain together, which would just be a stepping stone toward exclusive Spanish control over that territory that Spain has long said they rightfully should own. So I think it's just really interesting that they've made these statements so soon after it. And it's pretty easy to see why, in large part because of how the vote went. Britain as a whole, or the United Kingdom as a whole, voted, I think it was 52% to leave. But among the 30,000 people who live in Gibraltar, 95.9% of them said they wanted to stay in the European Union. So Spain's taken note of that. The European Union, other powers have taken note of that. And I think it could just put a lot of pressure on London to possibly, I'm not sure what the legalities of it might be, but it does look like this could weaken Britain's hold over the rock.
Well, there are so many prophecies at play in what we're seeing here. Obviously, this is a fulfillment of prophecy just in and of itself, Britain saying we want out. But here, this is another one that we've talked about so much over the years, the loss of Gibraltar and the sea gates that Britain had possessed at one point or another. And Gibraltar, we've been expecting this to go at some point, and this could very well hasten that, very likely would.
Yeah, back in May, before people even thought that Britain actually would leave, when the polls were much more in favor of a remain, spokesmen from both Gibraltar and the Falkland Islands, another of Britain's overseas territories, made pretty sobering statements saying if Britain leaves, then it would probably make it lose control over both of those territories. The first one of these is from, a spokesman from Gibraltar said on May 1st, I believe, in Gibraltar's case, experience has shown that Spain would take advantage of any such renegotiation in order to further undermine, isolate, and exclude Gibraltar from the European mainstream. And then the the Falkland Islands government representative Suki Cameron said, "A Brexit will have wide-ranging and deep implications. Were the UK no longer a member of the EU, that support would be much less certain from a large number of those EU member states and might encourage Argentina to be much more aggressive in its approach toward the Falklands." Argentina, of course, claims the Falklands as its own. And so these officials there in both the Falklands and Gibraltar are just very worried now. They feel that this could undermine their connection to Great Britain.
Right. Very easy to see how this would encourage all of those who've had a grievance against Britain for all these years to take advantage of the moment.
Yeah, and in terms of you know, the prophecy talking about Britain losing its gates, the sea gates, the gates of its enemies, I mean, these two are probably the two most strategic sea gates Britain has left. I mean, pretty much every other one around the world has been lost. These are the two gates that really point people back to that prophecy that, okay, Britain still has a little remnant of that empire that it did, but...
Well, let's talk about broader implications Europe-wide, how Europe is going to react to this, and what, how much do we expect Europe to retaliate against Britain making this decision?
Well, that's just one of many interesting questions. Before Europe has to retaliate, it has to figure out who it is. To be able to retaliate. Who is Europe's voice now? Who is Europe? Who is the EU? Is there an EU? I think you have to go back to the beginning. I think this is probably it's a massive inflection point for the European Union. By far the biggest inflection point since the European Union was created back in 1952. And I mean, we really are back to that question. Is there still a European Union? Even already today, Italy, the Netherlands, and France have come out and said, we want a referendum. I'm just going to quote a few statistics from a survey or a poll taken in May. Almost half of Europeans in the researched countries think their own country should hold a referendum on its EU membership. That statement or that fact should send chills down the spine of EU leaders. When asked how they would vote if a referendum on their country's EU membership was held, a third of Europeans in the selected countries say they would vote for their country to leave the EU. It's something like 48% of Europeans in some of these countries want to leave the European Union. So
there have been Europeans all over in all of these European countries, all of the EU member states who watched Britain very closely and who are celebrating today and popping the champagne because Britain said we're getting out. They said that's exactly what needs to happen here.
The French are even more inclined to view the EU unfavorably than the Brits are, according to this Pew poll. And it's like that across a whole host of European countries, even in Germany. 48% said they viewed it unfavorably compared to 50% favorably. So it's not popular anywhere.
It's throwing all of the questions about what is the European Union and how do we go forward. All of these questions have been really at the forefront as all of these, the Euro crisis, the immigration crisis, all of these crises have been hitting Europe, and it's been in the public discussion. This pushes everything right to the forefront, and they have to answer these questions.
Right, and I think there are two general options. The first option is to dismantle this thing and rebuild it. The second option is for the EU leaders to double down on their tyranny and their undemocratic ways and say, we're not going to give you a referendum. We don't care what you think about the EU. And now that Britain's gone, we're going to integrate further. That I think is one really interesting part of this to think about is, you know, Britain joined the European Union, and part of its role or part of the reason Britain joined the EU was to slow things down. It was kind of like a checks and balances system. Mm-hmm. Britain was there to check German power. What happens now that the British millstone has been cut loose? France, I mean, nothing against the French, Jeremiah, but France does not have the clout to stand up and confront Germany. It doesn't have the economy. It doesn't have anything. So, I mean, you could see a scenario if EU elites ignore their people, which 20 years or 30 years shows that they have no problem doing, mm-hmm. you could see a scenario where integration could really take off. Churchill called Britain the arbiter of Europe. And this was partly or largely why Churchill saw Britain as part of the United States of Europe. It was to be there as a balancing power. It was to be – he viewed Britain pursuing its national interest within the EU. He didn't view Britain kind of giving over its national interest to the EU. And then when Britain joined the EU in 1973, it perpetuated that tradition. It was able to check Germany, and Britain, ever since it joined, has been kind of the prominent voice that represented EU countries that wanted to slow integration, that wanted to, you know, reject some of the legislation coming out of Brussels, Denmark. And there's probably four or five countries that aren't, you know, as pro-EU as Germany and some of the others. What are they? What do they do now that Britain isn't there? That'll be interesting.
But just to add to that as well about this idea that European leaders may, I do agree that it's a possibility that they would just rebuild it, but this idea that they might just push forward to more integration is, I think the way that a lot of them see it is the problems and the unpopularity is caused by Europe not having enough power. And I think in a way that's right. I mean, Europe has the power at the moment to create problems and it doesn't have the power to fix them. It's kind of stuck in this halfway house between being a super state. You know, it's got open borders, so all the immigrants come in. It doesn't have a border force to protect those borders. Mm-hmm. And then also I think there's a kind of this feeling among European leaders that they're getting blamed for mistakes made by national leaders. And that therefore, if they take away power from national leaders and bring that to themselves, they'll be able to fix everything. Yeah. So you could very easily see, well, you could easily see it being met by pushes for more integration. And the entire history of the European Union tells us that's how they respond to crises. They use these kind of crises to try and make a grab for more power.
Yeah, it will just be fascinating to see how European elites go about restructuring this union as some nations try to pull farther apart and some nations try to pull further together. I think there's a very great misconception that some people have about the European Union, like it's 28 equal member states, just like the United States is 50 equal member states. But it's not like that at all. There's only 17 of those states within the Eurozone that use the euro as their currency. So there's already at least two tiers, maybe more if you really want to get into it, break it down. And a lot of people look at that as a flaw, but I know I'd seen a couple recent lectures recently by Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, who's a former German defense minister, now works for advisory company in New York, saying that he really thinks that they need a union of, I guess the phrase he uses, concentric circles, where you've got a smaller group that if they're pro-immigration, let them integrate. And if you have a group that's a little less pro-immigration, then have a little bit looser and then a little bit looser. And so instead of having an equal union like the United States, you get like this hierarchical pyramid with certain nations at the top that are formed almost a super state and then other nations that are de facto and in fact almost ruled by those nations as you go down the hierarchy levels.
And we're seeing that already. And the six founding nations of the European Union are meeting tomorrow. So it's not the 27 nations, the six. They're looking at a smaller group to move on. And people like, you mentioned zu Guttenberg and also Wolfgang Schäuble in recent weeks, he's been making similar statements about getting back to a core Europe. Who else was it? I think it was Vivian Reding. Yes, she also said, you know, we need a core Europe. So there are people exactly looking to exactly that now as a solution. And I've seen even just throughout the day more European commentators, and I think maybe even François Hollande, if I remember correctly, within the last few hours has made some kind of a statement along the lines of we need a multi-speed Europe. So that is an idea that's gaining very quickly in popularity in result of the Brexit vote.
If I'm an EU elite and if I'm prepared to discard the opinions of the European people, which most are, I'm thrilled by what happened today because now I can operate without Nigel Farage hanging over my head. Now I can start really pursuing integration and not have to worry about what the British people are going to vote in a referendum. It'll be interesting to see now when EU officials, they don't have to worry about which way Britain vote. We all know without Britain there and being concerned if Britain's going to leave or not, now they can just do what they want to do. It's just an interesting, it's going to be really interesting to see. Europe at this moment in time doesn't know who it really is. It doesn't have an identity. It doesn't realize its power and its potential. But if it finds itself, if it finds an identity, it could be a significant and terrifying force in the world. I've played sports with people like this. I've played basketball with people who are tall, muscular, athletic, incredibly coordinated, but they didn't understand the game. They didn't understand strategy. And I always thought, if that guy realized who he is, and if he was able to bring all of those qualities together, he could absolutely crush me. He would be a force to reckon with. And I think Europe's a little bit like that. We've got a population of 500 million people. We've got Germany's leadership. It's sophisticated. It's got technology. It's got the Roman Catholic Church. All of the parts are there. If Europe can just somehow find its identity, then it could really be a pretty scary entity.
It's fascinating. You were talking before about just the restraining influence that Britain tried to possess all that time, that Churchill and leaders after him, that they were there to participate within the European project as a means of checking German ambition. I was thinking the same is true really of NATO. We've had this restraining influence of NATO, in an effort to keep the Germans down. And again, you see this fracturing of this alliance and an unshackling of potential within Germany in particular.
Yeah, one thing I think we need to watch, and we haven't talked about this yet, but is what happens now that Britain leaves? I mean, Britain has been one of the biggest opponents to Russian influence in Europe in recent years. I mean, it's been confronting Russia. Germany now, what does Germany do in this situation? Like, with Britain gone, does it move more towards Russia? Do we see a growing relationship between them? I think that's another thing on the radar.
To me, that's one of the most interesting questions. What does Germany do? And one thing I just thought about today is, at what point does Germany give up on collaboration and cooperation and trying to bring everyone together and trying not to offend anyone, trying not to be too strong? At what point do they just give up on that approach and just take control? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're already in the driver's seat, but Germany, because of its history, they have to make it seem like they're operating within the EU community. They have to seek the opinions of others. They kind of have to tread lightly. But if I'm Angela Merkel, and if I've got Greece and I have to fix that, and I've got Ukraine and I have to fix that, and I've got Russia and migrants and now Brexit, I mean, I'm getting close to the point of just saying, I'm done with being nice. I'm done with being collaborative. I'm done with getting everyone else's opinion. Every other country around here is taking care of their self-interest. It's time for Germany to take care of its self-interest. It's time for Germany just to step in and fix this. If I'm a German leader, if I'm Angela Merkel, I'm starting to think like that. I would have been thinking like that 6 months ago.
I think that's a really interesting point. I think Brexit puts Germany especially in a really interesting position, because on the one hand, they've just got a big boost in power. Like others have been talking about, that break of Britain slowing things down has gone. They're now relatively a much more, their economic power now is vastly increased, because as a percentage of Europe's economy, they're now much bigger, and population as well. On the other hand, they just lost an ally. When it comes to Britain and Germany have a very similar view of Europe as kind of like an economic zone. They both do not like this idea of Europeans helping themselves to money from other countries. So they got an increase in power, but they lost an ally in voting. And so it kind of pushes Germany to do exactly what Mr. McDonald was saying. Take control kind of outside of those voting systems. If they just kind of sit back, well, they've much more vulnerable now to have Southern Europe vote themselves access to German taxpayers' money. And so they've got to step up. And they have a greater ability to step up because of their increase in relative power. So it really could push Germany towards that in a couple of ways.
I just have one quick thought. What is really remarkable about this is if Germany takes this approach, they're going to be embraced by the world. Most countries aren't even going to blink an eye if Germany does this. America and Germany's allies within Europe and even Britain, they want Germany to be more proactive, to be more independent, to take more control. It's amazing how it's all working out.
Well, it is worth noting, just to kind of wrap this discussion up, that this is a momentous event, and yet it will take time for all of this to play out. It's going to take time for, the actual departure to happen. And all of these things, we'll have to keep a close eye on it. But there is absolutely no doubt that this accelerated the timetable of so many huge prophecies that we put so much attention on at the Trumpet. So it's extremely exciting to see this happen. And we'll definitely have a whole lot more hours and hours of discussion in the time ahead as we watch this play out. But we really appreciate everybody's contributions to the discussion today. And I'll just say this, Robert and Brad, we'll let you guys go. We're going to do a big lightning round after this, and we appreciate both of you guys and the contributions that you made to the discussion today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All the stories that we're talking about are in this week's edition and a whole lot more. We're going to finish the program with trying to pack as much of the rest of the Trumpet Weekly into our discussion as possible. We'll give all the other panelists a chance to contribute there. So that's all coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to look at some of the other headlines that happened this week, and we'll start with Andrew.
A shocking report in the Wall Street Journal this week revealed that the Internal Revenue Service has spent nearly $11 million on guns, ammunition, and military-style equipment over the last 9 years. They now have 2,316 special agents with the arrest powers and firearm powers, meaning that they're spending nearly $5,000 in military gear per agent. The same report now revealed that the executive branch of the federal government actually now has more armed officers with arrest powers than the U.S. Marine Corps.
I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that. Next, over to Richard.
A couple of interesting pieces from the German military this week. One is, according to a comprehensive security paper that will soon be passed to the cabinet, is that the German army will be able to recruit European citizens for the first time ever. Until now, the army has generally been banned from recruiting non-Germans. The former defense minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, actually put this plan forward about 5 years ago, and it was blocked because it was too controversial. But now the members of the European Union will be allowed to join the German army. You put that alongside some of the other Europeanizations of the German army, the Dutch bringing on board talk of creating a European Panzer Corps by 2020. And it's quite a significant development and really just shows another step of the German military kind of absorbing other European militaries. And then also related to that, Angela Merkel announced a dramatic increase in spending in the German army and or the German military. Until recently, the German military was being cut every year. Now that's just slightly turned the corner. And then she announced a major acceleration of that. I believe they'll be upping their military spending to around 1.5% of GDP, spending an extra few billion on, and especially on updating their equipment.
All right, we'll go now over to Jeremiah.
U.S. Army Chief of Staff General Mark Milley has ranked the four countries that he says pose the gravest threat to America's security. Number four, North Korea. The combination of its belligerent military, its petulant leader, its lack of resources, and its nuclear capability make it an unstable nation with very little to lose, he says. Number three is China, which is becoming more and more assertive and aggressive. Number two, he says, is Iran, who, despite their claims to the contrary, he believes are in hot pursuit of nuclear weapons. And number one, according to General Milley, is Russia, which he says is literally an existential threat that can physically destroy us.
All right, let's go now to Andrew.
Democratic lawmakers in the House of Representatives organized a sit-in this week where they sat on the floor in protest of Republican refusal to vote on new gun control bills. The new bill in question would deny anyone on an FBI terrorist watch list the right to purchase a firearm. Republicans argue that the laws would encroach on both the Second and the Fifth Amendment of the United States by banning someone the right to own a firearm without trial by jury first.
Moving on, we'll go to Brent.
The European Union decided earlier this week to extend and expand its Mediterranean naval mission off the coast of Libya. Operation Sophia, as it's called, has been working for the past year, and it was mainly employed to stop and disrupt human trafficking from Libya into Italy. But now they've expanded that, or extended that through 2017, but expanded it also that they will be able to actually enforce a arms embargo that is currently set up in Libya. Now, if you'll remember to, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, the EU got together and they decided that only one government of the two currently working in Libya would be able to receive weaponry from the United States and from Europe. And once they did that, they said no other group is going to be able to receive them. Then they pleaded to the United Nations Security Council for the right to make sure that happens and actually police the arms embargo. So now they're going to get to do that with their own warships, being able to board and potentially take any vessel that they deem is possibly breaking the weapons embargo. Now, this deal was worked out to try and stop arms from getting to the Islamic State. At least it was peddled that way. Yet the Islamic State doesn't have access right now to any seaport whatsoever in northern Libya. So who are they trying to stop? Well, they're probably trying to stop the other rival government from gaining power. Now, what's Europe's motive in this? The Russians didn't know what Europe's motive was in this, and they actually questioned it at the United Nations Security Council and said, we don't know what Europe's doing. We're going to let them do it, but we're going to keep an eye on you. Now, added to this, Ursula von der Leyen, the German defense minister, she just said that next year we're going to have 950 German troops dedicated to this mission, up from the 400 that they have right now. So that's something to watch and see if it progresses further than just stopping weaponry entering the coast of Libya.
All right, and we'll finish with Andrew.
Routine use of small drones by real estate agents, farmers, filmmakers, and other commercial operators, which was approved by the Obama administration on Tuesday. The decision comes after years of planning and writing rules that would protect public safety and allow more use of drone technology. The Federal Aviation Administration announced the creation of a new category of aviation rules for drones weighing less than 55 pounds. The rule means commercial operators can fly drones without special permission. Industry and government officials describe commercial drones as one of the biggest game-changing technologies in aviation since the advent of the jet engine.
Well, I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. You can look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank our panel today, our mega panel, Brad McDonald, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with the words of Winston Churchill. We are with Europe, but not of it. We are linked, but not combined. We are interested and associated, but not absorbed. If Britain must choose between Europe and the open sea, she must always choose the open sea. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.